Welcome to Torah Yimecha Nachyomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Lynn Kraft, and today we'll be learning Melachim Bet Perek Hey, Chapter 5. In the last perek, in Perek Dalet, Chapter 4, we learned of Elisha's miraculously saving four different students slash supporters of his, who each experienced a significant lack in their life, which he was then able to provide for. And in this perek, we're going to see that now, for the first time, Elisha's fame spread beyond the borders of Eretz Yisrael into the northern country of Aram. And at face value, the perek really just seems to be like just another story of Elisha's wondrous miracles in which he brought to life, brought life to someone who was lacking something significant. And in this case, you know, it was their health. However, when analyzed further, we'll see that emerging from the text are important themes of power and subservience and the inversion of this dialectic as the plot develops. So for instance, the two milim manchot, or repeated words, which are each repeated seven times in the perek, are Adon, which means master, and is a clear reference to power and authority, and Lifnei, meaning before, which is indicative of standing before someone in subordination to them. So in Pasuk Aleph, verse 1, we're told that the general of Aram, whose name was Naaman, contracted Tzara'at, or leprosy. And the way that Naaman is described in Pasuk Aleph is actually divided into four different clauses, and each clause is comprised of two phrases. And what's interesting is that in each clause, the first phrase seems to allude to the substantial power Naaman wielded in his country of Aram, while the second phrase appears to minimize the true extent of his authority. So let's begin with the words of the Pasuk. Naaman sar tzava, Melech Aram. And Naaman was the general of the army of the king of Aram. So while Naaman had authority over all of his soldiers, he was still subservient to the king, who is really the one in charge of the entire army, including its general, Naaman. Second clause is Haya Ish Gadol Lifnei Adonav. He was a great man before his master. In other words, Naaman was a man of great fame and influence in Aram, but he was still subservient to his master, who was the king, who was in fact the very reason why Naaman had any prestige in the first place. The third clause is Unesu Panim Kivonatan Hashem Chu'al Aram. He was held in high esteem, or literally his people looked up to him, because through him, Hashem gave salvation to Aram. So it seems that Naaman was really, truly respected for his military victories, but it was really Hashem who enabled his success. And then finally, we're told, V'ha'ish hayagi borchayel mitzora. And the man was a strong warrior and had tzara'at, leprosy. So while Naaman is described as strong, his tzara'at has now compromised that strength and his overall health. Now the question remains as to why Naaman was afflicted with leprosy. And in fact, the text of the perek does not provide a reason, but perhaps we can understand this better based on a Gemara in Erechin, Daf Tet Zayin Amud Aleph, in which Chazal suggests actually seven different reasons why a person might become afflicted with tzara'at. The first of which, as we'll see, is very familiar to many of us from the story of Miriam in the Midbar, but it's really only the first of a total of seven different reasons provided as being potential causes of tzara'at. And the Gemara tells us, Amar Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmani, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Al Shivad Zvarim Nigaim Bain. So Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmani said that Rabbi Yochanan said that plagues, primarily leprosy, tzara'at, come for seven different matters, seven different things. Al Lashon Hara, for evil speech, Ve'al Shvichot Damim, for bloodshed, Ve'al Shvuat Shav, for taking an oath in vain, Ve'al Giloy Arayot, for forbidden sexual relations, Ve'al Gasut Haruach, for arrogance, Ve'al Hagezel, for theft, Ve'al Tzarat Ayin, and for stinginess. And based on the context of our parak, even just what we already learned from Pesuk Aleph alone, from verse 1 alone, it really seems that the most likely cause of Naaman's Tzara'at was in fact Gasut Ruach, or arrogance or haughtiness. In fact, he is described as an ish gadol, a great man who had a lot of power, a lot of authority over others, who seems to have actually been brought down a notch by this debilitating illness of tzara'at. The parak continues in Psukim Bet through Hey, verses 2 through 5, in which we're told that Naaman's wife's maidservant, who was a young Jewish girl captured by Aram in one of their many military skirmishes in northern Malchut Yisrael, told her mistress that there was, in fact, a Navi, a prophet in Shomron, the capital city of Malchut Yisrael, who could cure Naaman of his sarat. And when Naaman heard this, he immediately went to tell his master, the king of Aram. And it's interesting because the process by which Naaman found out about Elisha was actually framed in this way by a very specific hierarchy and chain of command, right? First, Elisha was initially recommended by this young slave girl from Eretz Yisrael, who was captured and ultimately enslaved by Naaman's wife. And then Naaman's wife was clearly subordinate to Naaman herself, as the text doesn't even give her a name. Rather, she's referred to as Eshet Naaman, the wife of Naaman only. And further, Naaman is referred to as Adon, the master, in her presence. And then Naaman himself was subordinate to the king of Aram and needed to receive his permission in order to see Elisha. And yet, ironically, it was this assumedly powerless slave girl, referred to as a Na'araktana, as a small girl, who was on the lowest rung of the hierarchy here. She is the one who ultimately saved Naaman, this powerful man who's described as an Ish Gadol, right? A great man. In fact, later in the perek, after Naaman became cured of his sarat, his skin will be described as similar to that of a Na'ar Katan, a small boy, which is a clear reference to this Na'araktana, this small girl who was really the cause of his salvation in the first place. And so we see that the ultimate inversion of the accepted power structure really serves to undercut the aforementioned hierarchy. Now, after being told about Elisha by Naaman, the king of Aram proceeded in Pasuk Hey, verse 5, to send a letter to the king of Malchut Yisrael. Both kings actually remain nameless throughout the entire narrative. We're not giving their names, just their position and the names of their countries. And we're told that along with this letter, he sent money, gold, and clothing, demanding that the king of Malchut Yisrael cure Naaman of his sarat in return for payment. And we're told the contents of the letter in the next pasuk, in pasuk Vav, verse 6. Va'ata kivoa sefer haza elacha, hine shalachti elacha et Naaman avdi, va'asavto mitzarato. And now, when this letter comes to you, I have sent you my servant Naaman, so that you can cure him of his leprosy. And it's interesting because the letter that the king of Aram sent to the king of Yisrael did not begin with all the flowery praise that one would expect a king to shower upon a fellow royal, but it rather begins very curtly with the words ve'ata and now, right? In other words, you better listen to what I tell you now, right? And it's very clear from this wording that the king of Aram viewed the king of Yisrael as a subordinate, right? Serving yet another example of the power hierarchy at play in this parak. Further, by offering payment, the king of Aram was actually suggesting that the king and his prophet of Malchut Yisrael were in his employ, and that he, the king of Aram, was in control of them, and he, as the king of Aram, could compel the king and the prophet of Malchut Yisrael to do his bidding. Whereas in truth, we know that really Jewish Nevi'im prophets work for Hashem. They don't work for anyone else. And this dichotomy between the pagan approach and the Jewish approach to Nevi'im is actually explained beautifully by Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch in his commentary to Vayikra Perek Yud Pasuk Bet in the context of Karbanot. And he says, quote, Judaism and paganism go in diametrically opposite directions. The pagan brings his offering in an attempt to make the god subservient to his wishes. The Jew, with his offering, wishes to place himself in the service of God. By his offering, he wishes to make himself subservient to the wishes of his God. In other words, according to Rav Hirsch, pagans offer sacrifices in an attempt to make their God subservient to their wishes. And this approach similarly informed their interactions with their God's prophets, right? I pay you so that you do and say what I want. But Jews, on the other hand, offer sacrifices to make themselves subservient to the wishes of God. And this also informs our interactions with Hashem's Nevi'im, right? We don't pay them since they don't work for us. We know that they work directly for God and that they're not in our control. Rather, we understand that we're subservient to the God whom these Nevi'im represent. And perhaps this dichotomy can help explain the king of Yisrael's reaction to reading this letter in Pasuk Zion, verse 7. He tears his clothing in mourning and proclaims, Ha'elokim ani, lahamitu lahachayot, ki zeh sholeach elei la'asof ish mitzarato, am I God to bring death and to bring life, that this man is sending me to cure a man of his leprosy? And it seems that the king of Yisrael reacted to the letter with such panic, perhaps because his more powerful northern neighbor had just sent him an order to save the life of his general, which was impossible for the king of Yisrael to fulfill. He himself didn't have the power to cure Naaman of his sarat, and he didn't even have the power to order his own Navi around and compel him to do it for him, because he knew that his Navi was not in his employ, but rather in God's. So it seems that the king of Aram just assumed that the power structure in Eretz Yisrael was very similar to that in Aram, in which the prophets were in the service of the king, and they must obey the king's command. And so the king of Aram couldn't even conceive of a prophet who was not subservient to the king. But in stark contrast to the king of Aram's assumption, the king of Yisrael knew that the Navi was not in his service, or in fact in service to anyone other than Hashem, and actually frequently critiqued the king when he did something wrong. And so the king of Yisrael couldn't even conceive of a situation in which the Navi would be under his control. And he therefore didn't even think initially to call upon Elisha to help him fulfill the king of Aram's orders. He just kind of, you know, reacted in mourning and distress. And it was Elisha himself who, upon hearing what happened with the king, told him in Pasuk Chet, verse 8, that he should send Naaman to him, so that Vayeda ki yesh navi b'Yisrael, so that he will know that there is a prophet in Israel. And that's how Naaman ended up at Elisha's doorstep in Pasuk Tet, in verse 9. And in the next Pasuk, Pasuk Yud, verse 10, we're told that Elisha sent a messenger out to Naaman to give him the instructions that would cure his sarad. Haloch v'rachatzta shava pa'amim b'yardin, v'yashov Bisar Chalacha Utahar. Right, go and wash 7 times in the Jordan River, and your skin will return to you, and you will be pure. In Psukim Yudalef to Yudbet, in verses 11-12, Naaman became infuriated upon hearing these instructions, since he had expected a much more grandiose ritual for a man of his stature. Because based on his own pagan conceptions of appropriate hierarchy, Naaman assumed that he, as the king's general, controlled the prophet, and not the other way around, such that he deserved a lot more respect than Elisha was bestowing upon him. And we see these preconceived notions manifest themselves in several ways. First, Naaman thought that Elisha should have come out to greet him, whereas instead, Elisha stayed in his house and sent out his messenger, who was likely Gehazi, as we'll see him named later on in the parak as Elisha's messenger. Elisha stayed home and sent out his messenger to give Naaman the instructions without bothering to get up, go out, and greet him for himself. Second, Naaman thought that Elisha should have done all the work for him, waving his hands around like a magician, right, to cure his sarat, while he, Naaman, remained passively seated high up in his chariot. But Elisha now expected him to be actively involved in his own healing process, traveling to the Yarden, immersing himself in it 7 times. And finally, Naaman was expecting what he referred to, or what actually his servants later referred to as a zavar gadol, this grandiose ritual to purify him. He was not expecting the small and insignificant act of bathing in the small and insignificant Yarden, which he felt was beneath his dignity. He even contrasted the waters of Israel to the greater, larger rivers of his hometown, Damascus, today's Damascus, asking why he couldn't have just stayed home and immersed himself in those larger, more impressive rivers near to where he lived. Ironically, in Pasuk Yud Gimel, in verse 13, it was Naaman's lowly servants who ultimately persuaded their master, who initially had been described as an Ish Gadol, a great man. They persuaded this Ish Gadol to follow Elisha's advice, since small and insignificant acts can sometimes make more of a difference than a davar gadol, than a great thing. So, in Pasuk Yudalet, in verse 14, a convinced Naaman was yored to the Yarden. He went down, he descended to the Jordan River in order to be cured. And we know that both of those words, yored and Yarden, share the shoresh of yarad, yud, resh, dalet, which means to descend, implying that Naaman, who was afflicted with sarat, likely due to his haughtiness, needed to be lowered down a notch in order to be cured of that sarat. And as a result of this immersion in the Yarden, we're told, Vayeshev bisaro kivsar na'ar katon vayitar. We're told that his flesh was restored like the flesh of a small child, and he became pure. And so ironically, the man who was originally described as an Ish Gadol, as a great man, is now described as appearing like a Na'ar Katon, like a small child. And as we mentioned earlier, in this way, the Ish Gadol, the great man, is now described in a parallel way to his lowly Jewish slave girl, the Na'ara Ktana, who originally saved him by recommending Elisha in the first place. And so again, we see the inversion of ancient Aramean society's accepted hierarchy and power structure, in which the Ish Gadol is now looking like a Na'ar Katan and is much more similar to his Na'ara Ktana, his wife's slave girl, than he was to you know, to his own original high stature. And this is only one of several simultaneous reversals that we saw, that we see on the part of Naaman after he was purified due to his following Elisha's advice. In fact, in Pasuk Tet Vav, in verse 15, upon Naaman's return to Elisha, now Naaman approached Elisha himself, and he even referred to himself as Elisha's servant, which is in stark contrast to when he first arrived at Elisha's home, when he refused to even leave his chariot at all and expected Elisha to greet him and do everything for him while he passively sat and did nothing. But perhaps even more shockingly, Naaman proclaimed his belief in God, in Hashem, as the supreme deity of the entire earth, completely renouncing his former polytheistic beliefs. He says, "Hinei nayadati ki ein Elokim b'chol ha'aretz ki im b'Yisrael. Behold, now I know that there is no God in the entire earth except in Israel." And so we see that Naaman even continued to claim in the following psukim that he will not serve any other gods anymore, but will only serve Hashem. One last reversal on the part of Naaman deserves attention as well. Whereas initially the king of Aram offered to pay for Elisha's services, implying the king's dominance over the Navi, now in Pasuk Tet Vav, verse 15, Naaman offered a gift to Elisha instead, implying his own subservience to the Navi. For when offering someone a gift, we actually acknowledge that we were in need and then benefited from that person's help. However, still, in Pasuk Tet Zayin, verse 16, Elisha refused Naaman's gift because he didn't really do anything himself. He rather wanted it to be clear that it was Hashem who did everything. And he especially wanted that to be clear to Naaman because he wanted Naaman to know the true source of his miraculous purification. Unfortunately, after Naaman left in Pasuk Yotet in verse 19, Gehazi, who was Elisha's servant and perhaps even his primary student, betrayed Elisha in the following psukim, in psukim chaf to chaf tzalad, verses 20 to 24, by chasing after Naaman to ask him for his previously offered gifts, claiming falsely that his master Elisha sent him to do so. And by doing this, Gehazi really demonstrated that he had totally missed the point, because Elisha's miracles were not for his own personal gain, and he didn't do any of them himself. They were all from Hashem. By asking for the gifts, Gehazi was insisting that Elisha receive the honor that Gehazi believed his master deserved. It's as if the power of being Elisha's main servant and even potentially main student had gone to Gehazi's head. And so we see that the very pride that had originally caused Naaman's sarat, and which had since been replaced by Naaman's newfound humility, was now taken off by Gehazi himself. And therefore, it's not so surprising that in the last pasuk of the parak, in Pasuk of Zion, verse 27, Elisha punished him with the very same tzara'at as Naaman originally had. "V'tzara'at Naaman tidbak b'cha u'b'zaracha le'olam." Elisha curses Gehazi by saying, "And the leprosy of Naaman will cleave to you and your descendants forever." And so in this way, we see that the obsession with power that Naaman had in the beginning of the parak, which Elisha succeeded in bringing down by commanding him to go down to the Yardin, which itself means to go down, right, in order to purify himself. Unfortunately, just as Naaman gave up that very obsession with power, that same obsession with power was like almost like snatched up by Gehazi, right, Elisha's primary student and helper. And so the lesson that had been internalized by Naaman as to the true role of Hashem in his purification was then reversed by Gehazi's actions when he attempted to bring the power back to his master, right, Elisha. And so in this way, Gehazi's inappropriate actions actually flipped the script back to the beginning of the parak. Rabbi Jachter, in his book on Sefer Melachim, entitled From David to Destruction, actually points out that it's very likely that until now, Elisha had viewed Gehazi as his likely successor, the way that he himself had succeeded Elisha. If we remember in Perek Dalid, he sent Gehazi to revive the son of the Isha Shunamit who had died. And in this parak, right, he definitely features very prominently, and he sends Gehazi out to give Naaman instructions. It really seems like he was almost training him as his successor. However, this episode clearly demonstrated to Elisha that Gehazi did not merit to succeed him as Navi. And so despite his previous high hopes for Gehazi, he now decided at the end of this parak to cut him off completely. In fact, we never hear of Gehazi again in the text of Sefer Melachim. And just in conclusion, I think that one of the main messages of this parak is that it's not all about power and hierarchy, right? Sometimes the most important things in life come from the mouth of a na'arak tana, of a small girl, or in the form of small and seemingly insignificant things. And many times we ourselves can become so focused on the title we have, or the social standing, or the authority, or the power we enjoy, that they almost can become masks that we hide behind. And it's really important for us to realize that in order to truly recognize Hashem, we really have to remember to always stand humbly lifanav, before Him. This year is dedicated by Michelle Levine and Susan Schuster and their families in memory of their beloved mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother, Rebbetzin Gloria Leff, Golda Tzivia Bat Baruch. Rebbetzin Leff was a highly regarded principal and Torah teacher, a master educator, whose deep love for teaching Tanakh inspired hundreds of students throughout her lifetime.